The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas B. Gibbs, a broadcast that examines our ever-changing world through the lens of the United States Constitution. Douglas B. Gibbs is on the air.
Mr. Constitution Hour, Douglas B. Gibbs here on KPRZ. Welcome to the program. We're working our way through the Constitution, and we've gotten to Amendment 18, which is prohibition. When the temperance movement finally got its way, the temperance movement had been around for, over 100 years. And finally, in 1919, the 18th Amendment was ratified, and the temperance movement got its way, and prohibition went into place. Alcohol, or at least the manufacturing and transportation and sale of alcohol, became outlawed by and the federal government enforced this. It was a constitutional amendment. Now, before we get into what the Constitution says, let's talk a little bit about alcohol. The Bible says that wine is a mocker. Intoxicating drink arouses brawling. That's in Proverbs chapter 20, verse 1. Bible also says, woe to him who gives drink to his neighbor, pressing him to your bottle, even to make him drunk. Habakkuk 2:15. So, it's understandable that the Christian women of the age thought, hey, we don't like our husbands drunk. We don't like our uncles drunk, our sons drunk. Our father's drunk. We want to stop this thing that causes such bad behavior in our society. Now, that said, we have to remember that the Bible doesn't necessarily say that drinking a glass of wine or beer or cocktail with dinner is a sin. And it really comes down to moderation. Drunkenness is a sin, forbidden by the Bible. But having alcohol in moderation, where it does not create behavioral changes and things like that, may not necessarily be a problem after all. So, got the age-old question. Christians have been asking this since day one, and the Christian women who were behind the temperance movement that eventually encouraged the 18th Amendment to be ratified, which outlawed the manufacture, sale, and transportation of quote-unquote intoxicating liquors within the United States. They believed it was a sin. But, and sometimes what's associated with drinking alcohol beverages could be a sin. Okay, so we have drunkenness. So what about someone who stumbles with alcohol? They have, they're now sober. They have they used to have a problem, alcoholism, something like that. Would drinking around them cause someone to stumble? The Apostle Paul establishes a rule of conduct in Romans 14:4-21, where he says that he would not eat meat or drink wine or do anything else that would cause a weaker brother to stumble. So, it's also a matter of knowing when to have a drink, how much, where, so on and so forth. So there's a lot that goes along with it. And in a country where we have at least 20 million problem drinkers and millions of others who use alcohol to excess, we do have to say that, we have to understand that Christians can't be like, well, I could drink alcohol, beverages because Bible doesn't say I can't. And as long as I'm in moderation, I'm okay, because our conduct, could be affecting other people. So our conduct should be governed by all of our other conduct, the way all of our other conduct must be in operation, by the law of love, by making sure we're not causing others to stumble, by acting in a manner or doing things in a manner that is a good witness. I mean, if I love my brother, I'm not going to cause him to stumble. I'm not going to, offend him. I'm not going to get into the woke thing. Well, you can't offend anybody. People get offended. I get that. But we shouldn't, as Christians, go out of our way to cause such a situation. And so, I myself, for example, I'm not really one to drink much. I tease my Thursday night Constitution class at Carlsbad because I'll have a beer with them after class, and I have one beer. And so I tell them my entire drinking habit is their fault. You know, it's a joke, of course. It's not really their fault. I can make my own decisions because most of the time on Thursday night, I'll have a beer with them. And that's all I pretty much drink all week, unless I maybe have a beer or a margarita or something like that with dinner when my wife goes out. But, I mean, I probably got more fingers and toes than drinks I have a year other than that one beer after class. And for that particular group, it's a social thing. One beer is fine. I'm not causing anybody to stumble. We are all in that environment to have that beer and talk and enjoy each other's company, to fellowship as constitutionalists, and they're all fellow Christians. But if I'm in a situation where I'm out and, you know, having a meet someone at a restaurant or something, and I know, or maybe I don't know, that they have had problems with alcohol, it might not be a good idea to have a drink. So as Christians, we need to be aware. We need to pay attention to our surroundings, the people around us, and what would be the right thing to do as a Christian. Once again, I'm not getting into some woke thing where we got to tippy toe around everybody. That's taking God's golden rule to a satanic type of strange level where the law controls everything. And it really comes down to, you know, as a member of the body of Christ, what do we know we should do? Use our common sense, and I don't think that someone that goes out and has a drink necessarily is a big old sinner or something. But on the same token, it's just like anything. It's not necessarily what it is. Sometimes it's the context in which something happens. For example, it's not a sin to eat, but it is a sin to be gluttonous. So there's usually context that goes way beyond the simple matter. Now, that said, a believer's body isn't, in fact, the temple of the Holy Spirit. And so for some, pouring liquor into the temple of God is kind of hard without defiling it, one would say. Liquor destroys blood vessels and brain cells if done in excess, if done in moderation. It's not harmful, or at least that's what science tells us. Long-term consumption of alcohol beverages at a high level can cause cirrhosis of the liver, lead to delirium tremens, and make for habitual alcoholism. So we get all that. So once again, as a Christian, you take all of this into account. You make your decisions accordingly. My biological father was an alcoholic, and so I know what alcoholism can do to people. And obviously we don't want to have our minds fogged by drinking at times of worship with God. You know, I mean, if we're going to be worshiping with God, we're going to be fellowshipping with other Christians, we'll be going to church, probably not the time to have a drink. I mean, even 1 ounce of liquor can begin to bring on intoxication in some people. 2 or 3 ounces can make a person legally drunk when it comes to the harder alcohol, and it depends. Once again, it depends on the person. Half of all the traffic, you know, deaths in the United States are caused by people who had at least one drink prior to driving. So our money, our lives, our bodies, it all belongs to Jesus. And to subject them to a state of intoxication, well, that can hardly be said to glorify the Lord or be an act of faith. Once again, moderation, if it's not something that's an intoxication, it's not causing us to stumble, you know, you be the decision. You know your body, you know your life, you know what you believe is proper. But it is not in our best interest to be intoxicated as a Christian and use that as a public witness. So we, you know, and then, of course, some people say, well, gosh, Jesus, you know, changed water to wine. Well, there was, in ancient Israel, for the most part, there wasn't any alcoholism. There was, and there's a little problem with it in Israel today, as a matter of fact. In Jesus' day, wine was used at meals and in ceremonial functions and for special parties as a national matter. Wine was not a problem for them. The wine of that time probably had a very low alcohol content, or it may just been a grape derivative that didn't have any alcohol content. You know, it might have been unfermented wine. We don't know. But Jesus lived in a society in which alcoholism was not a problem, as it is in our day. So for him, and in the context of that culture, wine was not a problem, whether it was capable of intoxicating or not. But today in America, you know, the alcohol is a different thing. There is a intoxication factor that's there. So once again, as a Christian, you know, you judge your surroundings, you judge your situation, you take all of that into context. Same thing when we talk about the Constitution, when we talk about the history that's around it, we're taking everything into context. There's always more than what meets the eye. What we have, what we see, what's going on, it's always deeper than what's on the surface. And so as Christians, we need to take everything into account. And so like I said, in my case, you know, the only time you'll probably see me drink alcohol is with my wife, where I have a, you know, margarita with dinner or something like that on rare occasion. I think I do that about once every couple months. Or I, you know, I have a beer with, you know, people from my constitution class who are also partaking. It's a social situation. None of us are getting intoxicated. It's a part of our fellowship as constitutionalists after the class to discuss how the class went and so on and other issues and all of that. So once again, you know, you got to take everything into context and make your decisions from there. When it comes to drinking and, you know, we have to remember also that alcohol is, you know, like a drug. It intoxicates, you know, it alters, it can alter your system if, you know, not in moderation, if in excess, you know, and the alcohol can change, you know, the way you behave, no different than cigarettes or narcotics could. And so for some people, they need to make a total break. They have to get rid of anything that, and they have to get rid of anything that might tempt them. So, you know, for some people, when they find Christ and they die unto themselves and give their life up to Jesus Christ, all of that alcohol or drugs or cigarettes or whatever it was that they had in their life, quite often they will pour that down the drain. They will throw it out because the commitment to Christ is more important. And so once again, for some people, it has to be a complete break. Some people who don't have issues with dependency and habitual behavior, things like that, like me, you can kind of, you know, moderation when it comes to alcohol every once in a while. But once again, it depends on the person, it depends on the situation, and it depends on your surroundings. So I must confess that, you know, when I became a Christian as a child, that was not something that was in my life. It was not a concern. My stepdad wasn't a drinker. I think I've seen him drink a beer twice in my whole life. He just doesn't. My folks did smoke when I was younger. They have both since quit. I smoked for a while. I quit because, you know, the nicotine in my body and all that was, you know, not good. It was not good for me. Eventually, I came to that conclusion. And as a Christian, I came to realize that it wasn't a very becoming image. Hey, Doug's a Christian. Look, he's standing there with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. So it wasn't a very good image. I didn't believe it was a good image. I've never been into, you know, necessarily smoking marijuana or anything like that. But whatever it may be, once again, in your life, you know, if you've got Christ, you need to, and it could cause you to stumble or others to stumble, you need to give it up. Because once again, you accept Christ, your body becomes a temple of the Holy Spirit. And so you must ask yourselves these questions. Am I defiling that temple by pouring this alcohol into it or by smoking this item or taking this drug or whatever? And if that is the conclusion, then, well, you then need to cut out the behavior. Now, I also don't hang out with those who are habitual. They have issues, alcohol problems, because, you know, it get me into trouble, or it could move me back into a direction where I might drink more. I did when I was in the Navy. And so it's also important for us to find others, preferably Christians, that, you know, believe as we do. They understand that the moderation of alcohol or no alcohol is better for them, and they're not, you know, smoking cigarettes or doing drugs, things like that. That's who we need to be hanging out with. If we're going to be children of Christ, we need to hang out with the children of Christ. Now, that does not mean that we're never around those who have not accepted Christ. We've got, Great Commission, spread the gospel, be out there in the public square. That's all important. And, so when it comes to these habits, once again, it's something that as a Christian we have to consider. We have to take into account all of the factors. And, the smell of cigarettes on you might not be a very good witness. Having a drink and laughing and hooping and hollering and getting so intoxicated you fall off the stool probably isn't the best message as a Christian. So just as we run our lives, just you've got to take all those things into account. Now, that all said, so the Christian women of early America, going all the way back to the 1800s, were pushing the temperance movement. They would actually go from town to town in a wagon with these logbooks. And if you drank, you could make a pledge, sign the logbook saying, I pledge to reduce my drinking to 50% or by a third or by 75%. Or, hey, you know what? I'm just going to totally give up drinking. So you put a T in that logbook, and that would make you a teetotaler. Yes, that is actually where that comes from. There were some drunks who would try to jump up on the wagon, and act like, they wanted to change their lives. They'd fall off the wagon. Yes, that's right. That's where that comes from. They fell off the wagon. And they went back to their drinking ways. And this movement, the abolition movement, the temperance movement, and other movements, the modernist and modern, the modernizers and the moralists, should I say, of the 1800s, they pushed all of this. It was the women getting politically involved. And so our mental health institutions and many of the hospitals and many of the other, the prison reform, all of that happened during that period in which women were getting politically involved. And these abolition, it was part of the abolition movement, part of women's suffrage, and yes, the temperance movement. That temperance movement came to a head in the early 1900s. And it was understood that on the horizon would be the vote of women. And you want to pay attention to what was important to them. You want to support what they support because they might be voting and you want their vote. So the prohibition went into place. Now I'm going to read Amendment 18. This is the amendment that put a prohibition into place. And we'll discuss the language of this amendment. And then we'll get into the amendment that repealed it after that, Amendment 21. So Amendment 18, if you've got your Constitution at the ready, Amendment 18, you'll notice in your Constitution, especially if you have one like I do, there's brackets around it. The brackets are basically mean that it's no longer in play. It's obsolete. It's been repealed. Section 1, Amendment 18, Section 1, after 1 year from ratification of this article, so they gave them a year notice, say, hey, once this thing's ratified, you have a year to get your whatever it is in order, to quit your drinking, to buy enough to get you through however long you think you're going to need to have it or whatever. After 1 year from the ratification of this article, the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors within the importation thereof into or the exportation thereof from the United States and all territory subject to the jurisdiction thereof for beverage purposes is hereby prohibited. So, rubbing alcohol for medicine, stuff like that is not prohibited. It's very careful to say the type of alcohol that is for beverage purposes. But notice it doesn't say that drinking alcohol as a beverage is outlawed. It says the manufacturer, sale, or transportation. Well, that's like saying we're not going to outlaw the guns, but we will outlaw the bullets. Well, you're not going to be able to buy any more bullets. Your gun's only as good as however many bullets you've got left. Same thing here. Your drinking is only as good as however much alcohol you have left. It's saying, hey, we're not going to outlaw drinking, but we are going to outlaw the manufacture, sale, and transportation. You've got a year to get your stuff in order. So what do you think happened to alcohol sales during that time period? during that year. Went nuts, I'm sure. Now, that all said, we get to Section 2. It says, the Congress and several states shall have concurrent power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. See, what's in the Constitution typically is, if it's given to the federal government as an authority, it's only a federal authority. If it's given, if it remains as a state authority, it's only a state authority. But this article, this amendment, was very careful to say, this is a concurrent thing. The police, the sheriff, the state police, or highway patrol, and federal police, or federal agencies, or federal law enforcement, or whoever it is, all of them can enforce this. Federal and states alike, concurrent. And when something is concurrent, that means that all parties or both parties have authority. You know, it's like at a school, you know, the teacher and the principal both can put you on detention. They have the concurrent power of giving to detention. But that detention may happen in a different setting depending, because the teacher is more about the class, the principal is more about the campus. So while they have concurrent issue, concurrent authority over giving detention, how it is applied may be different. Same thing here. So you got this concurrent authority. The states, cities, counties, all of that can enforce it along with the federal government, but the situations that may arise and how it is done may be different because the agencies are a different part of the system. But it is a concurrent issue. It could be enforced by anybody. Now, part of the problem was, though, is it became almost unenforceable. You know, law enforcement agencies do have other things to worry about, after all. All right, Section 3, this article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of the several states, as provided in the Constitution within 7 years from the date of the submission hereof to the states by the Congress. So, it's saying, number one, once this thing is proposed to the states, they've got 7 years to ratify it. If they don't ratify it, this dies. It's done. They did ratify it within 7 years. And then it says that it'll be ratified by the legislatures of several states. Congress, in their proposal, said this is how you're going to ratify it, through the legislatures. The states typically would have a choice, either through convention. The people would pick their delegates. The delegates would meet in convention and then vote on whether or not to ratify some. Or they could do it through their legislature, and the legislators would vote in the ratification, which typically was the way to do it. But in Article 5, it gives Congress the ability to say, hey, we're going to choose for you. Everybody has to do it this way or that way. And that's what they did here. So it says right here in the proposed amendment that it'll be ratified an amendment to the Constitution by the legislators of the several states as provided in the Constitution. It's a reference to Article 5 within 7 years of from the date of the submission hereof to the states by the Congress. So prohibition begins January 16th, 1919. This is about the same time that Harding was voted in office as president. He died shortly after taking office, and Calvin Coolidge became president. Calvin Coolidge became so popular as the vice president became president that when a re-election came up, he was elected as president. So he became president due to the death of President Harding, and then later on got elected as president for that second term. So during this time period, Coolidge had taken actions that was good for the economy. From an economic point of view, the economy was booming. Things were going well. But so people had a lot of money to spend because things were going well, but they couldn't buy alcohol legally. So these underground alcohol gatherings became the norm. And the mob, it was a heyday, and people could afford, they would pay for it, the illegal product if they had to. This is what was going on. So we have 1919, January 16th, 1919, the 18th Amendment was ratified, and the prohibition of the manufacture, sale, and transportation of intoxicating liquors within the United States and its territories became effective. Now, to look for the repeal, we go to Amendment 21. So Amendment 18 puts the prohibition in place. Amendment 21 repeals it. Best way to remember that, you cannot drink at 18, you can at 21. So 21st Amendment, the 18th article of amendment to the Constitution of the United States is hereby repealed. That's section 1 of the 21st Amendment. The transportation or importation into any state, territory, or possession of the United States for delivery or use therein of intoxicating liquors in violation of the laws thereof is hereby prohibited. In other words, whatever they were doing, they now can't do anymore. And when it comes to the enforcement of what they were enforcing, and this is from a federal level. Now, if the states, counties, cities want to continue to ban alcohol, they can, but the federal government has lifted the prohibition that is countrywide. To this day, there's still dry counties in certain places. I remember as a kid, I had an uncle in Arkansas. He used to complain because he lived in a dry county. He had to go, whenever he wanted to buy some drink, he had to go, a six-pack of beer or whatever, he had to go to the next county over to buy his alcohol. Then in Section 3 of Amendment 21, it says, this article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by conventions in several states. So look, they changed it from the state legislature to conventions. State legislature, the political people voted it in. The people, through their delegates, were to vote it out. That was a sure way of making sure that the amendment got ratified. Because it was the people, after all, wanted to get rid of prohibition. As provided in the Constitution, within 7 years from the date of submission hereof to the states by the Congress. Now, something else that we need to keep in mind is why. Why did they suddenly realize that in 1933, this thing was ratified, December 5th, 1933, why in the early 30s did they suddenly decide, you know what, we need to get rid of this prohibition thing? After 14 years, almost 15 years of prohibition, it's time to get rid of it. Why would they think that way? Because there was something else going on. What was going on? The Great Depression. And with the Great Depression, that meant that there was less revenue going to the government because people weren't making as much money. The wealthy weren't doing as well. Taxes were low. Revenue was down. And at the same time, we've got a new president saying, we need to put all of this New Deal stuff into play. All these things that I want to do, all these programs that are going to be expensive, and we got no money. Hey, I've got an idea, says someone. Let's tax alcohol, but we got to make it legal first. So they repealed prohibition, and the sale of alcohol went back in place. People started pouring their drink happily, and they were paying a tax to do so, increasing the revenue of the United States so that they could put in place some very unconstitutional, tyrannical New Deal things. So that's that is the 18th and 21st Amendment. That is prohibition. That's a little bit of background and all of that. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go through the 19th and the 20th Amendment. The 19th and 20th Amendment are going to go over women's voting and the presidential terms and elections and all that. So don't go anywhere. When we come back, that's what's next. Hi, my name is Douglas V. Gibbs. I am known as Mr. Constitution out there, and I have been an instructor on the U.S. Constitution since 2008, and I've been studying the document my entire life. I have written 8 books out there, and the latest being Creator, the first 125 myths of the United States Constitution. All of the books, each of them have important messages to give. All of them are about the Constitution except for one of them. One of them is called Silenced Screams, Abortion in a Virtuous Society. That's my only non-constitutional book, and even it has a constitutional angle to it when you read it. All of them are available at douglasvgibbs.com/store. I would appreciate if you purchased the books. I would hope you would learn from them. All I ask is that in return you let me know, and I would love to autograph the books. If you buy them from the store, they will be autographed. So thanks for being a part of this program on K-Praise, and let's read about the Constitution and be informed.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Our records indicate you've been lied to. Welcome to the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
All I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Tired of the lies? Come here for the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs. Radical, powerful, enlightening. The journey of America is a tale that needs to be heard. And Mr. Constitution tells it each week on the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs. Saturdays at 9 p.m. Pacific on K-Praise, San Diego's Salem Media radio station for Christian programming. FM 106.1 in North County, AM 1210 in San Diego, and online for the world at kprz.com. Creator by Douglas V. Gibbs is on sale now. His eighth book, A True Action Plan for Christians When It Comes to Restoring the Republic. The keystone of American liberty is the Creator. Without a godly foundation, like an arch without its keystone, our whole system comes crumbling down. Thanks to age-old ideologies and an ancient lust for power and wealth, once again, our world is upside down. Evil has become good, and good has become evil. The churches have been infiltrated, and the rule of law has been replaced by the rule of man. To restore our liberty and the virtuous nature of our country, we must understand what is happening and what to do. Creator is a book that illuminates the realities that swirl around the foundation of American liberty and addresses seven critical issues directly related to our system of liberty that we must understand, address, and fight. For if we are to reestablish our American way of life on a foundation and cornerstone based on the Founding Fathers' beliefs in our Creator, and as Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, the laws of nature and of nature's God, whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. That was in the Declaration of Independence, and now our time has come upon us. Now it is our turn. How do we address what is going on? What are the true causes of the rise of tyranny in America? What steps must we take as a people to keep the republic? It all begins with our Creator. On sale now by Douglas V. Gibbs. Learn more at Amazon.com or DouglasVGibbs.com/store. All right, welcome back to the Mr. Constitution Hour here on K-Praise, San Diego's Christian station, AM and FM for North County and San Diego. I was watching television one time, and this gentleman, Don Lemon or Don Limon or whatever he goes by, and I can't remember if it was MSNBC or CNN, it was something like that, and so this guy is trying to convince his audience at the time talking, that the Founding Fathers were sexist and that they went out of their way to make sure that women could not vote. They did everything they could to push women into the corner. Women were not considered to be equal with men, so on and so forth. And then, in addition to all of that, he says that, well, we know that women can't vote because right there in the Constitution it says that women can't vote. And my first response was, no, it doesn't. No, it isn't. And when you get back into looking at history, once again, you got to get back to context. First of all, there is nothing in the Constitution ever that said that women could not vote. There is also nothing in there talking about women being less than men. In fact, the word men, man, woman, women, those words are not in the Constitution. They're just not there. Word person is used often, but not men, women, whatever. And women, context of the time, really didn't care to vote in many cases because it was, first of all, a man's world. It was something that they weren't interested in. They had other interests based on, what the culture dictated at the time. And that's fine. And there were some women that did vote. They wanted to vote. In fact, if you get into the Constitution, it says that's up to the states. The states, you know, choose the manners and procedures of the elections. And 10 of the 13 states in their state constitutions or in their laws when it came to the election basically said that all inhabitants that met certain requirements could vote. Only 3 states said absolutely that women could not vote. New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, I believe it was. And, but the other 10 said, hey, all inhabitants, as long as you meet a certain requirement. One of those requirements was that you needed to own property to the value of at least 50 pounds. Now, once again, we get into now another thing where we get out of context. We don't understand what was really going on. And we have people say, oh, well, you know, property owners, in other words, that own real estate, were only men. That's not what it says in their laws. Property meant any property, any belonging, as long as you had personal property that equaled 50 pounds or more in value. Real estate could be a part of that, but it could be something else beyond real estate, first of all. Second of all, it was possible for women to own property, be it real estate or other kind of property. They tended to be single women. Single women could purchase things. Single women could inherit, and so on and so forth. When a woman got married, her belongings didn't become a man's. It became the couple's, the union's. And from the point of view of the founding fathers or the people of that time period, once you were a union, you were one. And so the man voted because that's the way it was. Woman didn't need to vote. The man was voting for the couple. And women tended not to own anything, but did the man. It was the couple's belongings. And people say, well, yeah, but it was really in the name of the man. The man was in control and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that's true. But by law, the man couldn't sell the stuff without the woman's permission too. It took both. And so that's, you know, not make up things, and let's consider the context of the time period. Now, that said, getting back to our temperance movement, when women started to get politically active in the 1800s with the temperance movement and the abolition movement, things like that. Well, with the temperance movement, they're stepping into a man's world here where men want to drink, the women are trying to stop them. And if you're a man, you're not real thrilled about women getting involved in the political arena. That is when laws began to surface disallowing women from voting. Because they were in the political arena starting to step on things that the men weren't appreciating. So, at the time of the Founding Fathers and the writing of the Constitution, women were able to vote. 10 of the states absolutely allowed it. But by the time you got to the war between the states, women really weren't voting. Why? Because women had been politically involved, the men felt threatened, and these laws started to go up, not allowing women to vote. Now, that doesn't mean women couldn't vote at all in the United States. As we moved westward, the vote for women began to open up. One of the appeals of the frontier life to the West was that women not only could vote, they could hold office. You sometimes saw a woman mayor or something like that out in the West. So, and this was a part of the growth of society and how things were going. And so, as time passed, places like Wyoming were allowing women to vote. Places like New York were not. Men were threatened. They felt threatened. So some places women could vote, some places women couldn't, and a women's suffrage movement was taking place. And women were saying, hey, we should be able to vote wherever we are. There should not be an allowance by any state saying a woman can't because of her sex. And so the push for an amendment to allow women to vote without, you know, the state interfering with that right. I don't think voting is right. I think it's a privilege of citizenship. Bushrod Washington, the nephew of George Washington, who was a justice in the Supreme Court, agrees with me, but that's a discussion for another time. But the idea was a citizen to vote shouldn't be determined based on their sex. A woman should be able to vote no different than a man, no matter what. And no state should be able to make law saying a woman can't. Yes, women could vote in some places. it was a lot of people believe, oh, well, women finally got the chance to vote in the 19th Amendment, and, you know, they just couldn't before. No, that's not necessarily so. Women voted in many parts of the United States. 19th Amendment just made sure they could in all parts of the United States. So 19th Amendment ratified August 18th, 1920. The right, I've noticed, by the way, this is about a year and a half after Prohibition went into play. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. So the 19th Amendment says, hey, you can't say someone can't vote just because of their sex. They still got to meet the other requirements, still got to be old enough, whatever. But you can't say they can't vote because of their sex. 19th Amendment. Then we have the 20th Amendment. With the 20th Amendment, they started realizing we needed to clarify some things, maybe even change some things regarding presidential elections. Originally, presidential elections were by electors. The electors were appointed by the state legislatures, and then they would vote on who they wanted to be president, and they were greatly influenced by the people who would campaign for their candidates. And so the electors did the voting, but as time passed, Andrew Jackson, back in the 1830s, had pushed this idea that there should be a more democratic style, that we should be more of a democracy. I'm not a fan of this, and we'll get more in detail on another program. But so the vote of the people for president began to be considered, and the electors voted based on how the people voted. Didn't used to be that way, became that way. As time passed, it became understood that as our society was advancing and quote-unquote progressing, that other changes would need to be made. And also, the time period between election and inauguration was quite long. The lame duck session went from November all the way to April, so they decided they want to tighten that up too, so they made some changes. 20th Amendment. 20th Amendment in your Constitution, Section 1, the terms of the President and Vice President shall end at noon on the 20th day of January. Now you know why January 20th is that inauguration day. And the terms of Senators and Representatives at noon on the third day of January of the years in which such terms would have ended if this article had not been ratified, and the terms of their successors shall then begin. So now, we're all these years later, 20th Amendment, by the way, 1933, this is what moved Inauguration Day to January 20th and has the senators and the representatives, their sessions starting, the new Senate or the new House, beginning on the third day of January. Section 2, the Congress shall assemble at least once in every year. That appears one also earlier in the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 4, I believe it is. And it says, you know, in that section, Article 1, Section 4, that Congress shall meet at least once per year, but when that was being discussed according to Madison's notes, there were those that actually argued that was too often. They didn't want to be there once a year. They had a farm to take care of. They had a store to keep. They had a profession or a practice to maintain. And besides, you know, the federal government has so few authorities, what would they do? And so what you saw was an argument saying that was too often. Now we've got this idea of Congress is almost always there, and they're always trying to make laws, and we wish they weren't sometimes. But anyway, so Congress shall assemble at least once in every year, and such meeting shall begin at noon on the third day of January, unless they shall by law appoint a different day. Well, if the third of January falls on a Sunday, for example, they might, you know, move it to the fourth, or, you know, to the second or something like that. But nonetheless, the first time that they meet as a Congress is to be January 3rd. Section 3, if at the time fixed for the beginning of the term of the president shall have died, the vice president-elect shall become president. If a president shall not have been chosen before the time fixed for the beginning of his term, or if the president-elect shall have failed to qualify, then the vice president-elect shall act as president until a president shall have qualified. So if the president dies, vice president just becomes president. But if the president fails to qualify, then they need to find someone else that would qualify. And the vice president holds the office or acts as president until that new person is chosen. And the Congress may by law provide for the case wherein neither a president-elect nor a vice president-elect shall have qualified. In other words, if neither qualified, then it's up to Congress to declare who shall then act as president, or the manner in which one who is to act shall be selected. And such person shall act accordingly until a president or vice president shall have qualified. In other words, if there's a qualification problem, once again, they don't just choose somebody to be president and that's that. They're going to act as president until someone qualifies. Still got to go through the process. Section 4. So 20th Amendment, Section 4. Congress may by law provide for the case of the death of any of the persons from whom the House of Representatives may choose a president whenever the right of choice shall have devolved upon them. And for the case of the death of any of the persons for whom the Senate may choose a vice president whenever the right to choice shall have devolved upon them. So, if the deaths are happening and things are not happening and the choice devolves upon them, then it's up to the House choose president, it's up to the Senate choose vice president. Why does the Senate choose vice president in those cases? Well, because they're choosing the president of the Senate. Vice president, remember, is also president of the Senate. Something that's not doesn't seem like it's a big deal today. Back then it was. The vice president was present in all meetings of the Senate. He was the gavel wielder. Unless he had other things to do or had to act as president, the vice president was on the floor in the Senate. Their vote, of course, did not matter unless there was a tie. But otherwise, they participated. Vice President wielded the gavel, led the debates, and debated himself. Section 5. Sections 1 and 2 shall take effect on the 15th day of October following the ratification of this article. Section 6. This article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of 3/4 of several states within 7 years from the date of its submission. Once again, we're getting these time limits to 7 years. The older proposals didn't have that. In fact, the 27th Amendment, when we get to it, we'll talk more about it, was one of the original Bill of Rights. It didn't have an expression. So it finally got ratified in 1992. This one says, hey, if we don't ratify within 7 years, it's dead. It's gone. It's a practice that the modern amendments all follow. I remember the Equal Rights Amendment, the ERA, back in the 70s, and it had a seven-year limit also. And when it wasn't approved within 7 years, they actually amended it to 3 more years to make a total of 10. Then when it wasn't amended by the states, it died. But it died. It's not just floating around out there waiting to be ratified. Same thing here with the 20th Amendment. 7 years from proposal. If it doesn't get ratified within 7 years, then it's not a part of the Constitution. It did get ratified, ultimately, January 23rd, 1923. So, or 1933, I mean. And so it's an interesting thing, though, that you see that they realized, hey, we can't have this stuff just floating around. Either it gets ratified or it doesn't, and we're going to give it a time period. We're going to give the states, we're going to encourage them to, you know, not mess around on this. Either ratify it or don't. Don't get ratified within a certain time. It's dead. It's gone. One wonders how many proposals died along the way. We have 27 amendments. How many amendments actually died along the way? I know with the original Bill of Rights, 12 went out to the states, 10 got ratified. One of those two that did not get ratified ultimately became the 27th Amendment. The other one never got ratified. It's still floating around out there. And in fact, that one would require one member of the House per 30,000 people, which would give us thousands of Congress critters. Not a fan of that idea. So we see this movement towards, when it comes to the Constitution and these amendments, two things. Number one, Congress starts deciding, you know, in some of the cases, like we saw in the 18th and the 21st, on how it's going to be ratified. And we got this limitation. Hey, it needs to be ratified within 7 years or it's no good. It's dead. That's the tendency, as the movement we are seeing. Now, we are approaching the end of the Constitution. When I get to the end, I'm going to start over, but I'm going to get into even more detail. I'm going to tell some other stories. We're also going to get into some issues before I start over on the Constitution. There's a lot of questions out there about a lot of things. You want to ask me a question? You want me to talk about it on this show? Shoot me an email at constitutionspeaker@yahoo.com, constitutionspeaker@yahoo.com, and I will answer your question on the air. We will talk about whatever topic you want to talk about, but you got to get a hold of me in writing. Also, this show is funded by you. You want to help, you know, fund the show? No problem. I appreciate the help because it doesn't get funded unless funds are provided. And I'll be frank, the battle that I fight is not just with this show. It's I have another radio show and I have other things that I do. And our country has never faced the kind of attacks that we are facing today from within. And I will continue to push for the Constitution and the education of the Constitution and petitions and other things that will resolve our problems. But it all needs to be funded. And here's how you fund it. You go to DouglasVGibbs.com or PoliticalPistachio.com. You hit the donate button, and you can, you know, by PayPal, by credit card. Or if you're into Venmo, and some of you know what Venmo is, Douglas-Gibbs-3. That's how you find me, Douglas-Gibbs-3. And you can Venmo me and send money to me that way. So you've got the website, you've got Venmo, or you could even write a check and email me at constitutionspeaker@yahoo.com and I'll tell you how. All right, that said, we got about a minute left, and I want to say thank you for joining the program. United we stand, combined we kick butt. God bless America, my friends. God bless you. Thank you for listening, and remember, you can not only listen to this on K-Praise, KPRZ.com, or 1210 AM, 106.1 FM in San Diego County. We are also on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Odyssey, and a whole bunch of others. There's like 8 or 9 of those channels. Go to DouglasVGibbs.com/radio, and you can find all of those links. Or just say to your computer, you know, hey, play Mr. Constitution Hour by Douglas V. Gibbs, especially at iHeart, and it'll come up with all my past episodes. All right, that's it. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. We'll continue through the Constitution. Amendment 22 is the beginning next week. Glad to talk to you. We'll see you next time. Have a great week.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.